This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Here at the Magic Word Podcast, we are dedicated to talking about magicians past, present, and future. This week, we're going to be talking with Chip Romero, who is a cruise ship magician, but also is a noted collector of Doug Henning memorabilia. We spoke a few weeks ago with Dr. Tim Moore, who is a dentist in Columbus, Ohio, and his focus is on Herman and also on Carl Germain. And I thought that it'd be kind of interesting to talk with Chip Romero, whose focus is on Doug Henning. Doug being someone who has influenced a lot of current magicians who are out there working right now. And I know that this is something that is of interest to others who may have heard of Doug, may not have ever seen him live, but have seen some of his videos. I know that many of you have been influenced by him in many ways, who are out there working today, who are closer to my age, who have been around for a while, because Doug Henning was very popular back in the 1970s, debuting his show, The Magic Show, on Broadway in 1974. That also earned him a Tony Award nomination. And because of that success, actually NBC producers tagged him for getting his own television special, which was Doug Henning's World of Magic, which was broadcast to over 50 million viewers in December 75. And that's what really brought him to the attention of America and to other magicians and said, hey, this guy is something. Doug Henning remained popular until his untimely death when he was age 52 back on February the 7th, 2000, and he died of liver cancer. It's interesting, I think, to note also that Houdini also died when he was 52, with the exact number in a deck of playing cards. Well, again, I want to introduce our guest this week who is going to talk about Doug Henning, and he can certainly talk, and there might be a follow-up in which I get a chance to go and visit his collection in his private home sometime over in Louisiana in the near future and take some photos that I will post, and I'm sure that you will enjoy as well. In fact, I always encourage everyone to go to themagicwordpodcast.com, where you will always see some additional content, that is, photos and videos when available, as well as being able to read the blog and enter the contest. And speaking of contests, we had one this last week that was going to be for one of three copies that is being given away of Nate Staniforth's book, This Is Real Magic. We're not going to announce the winners this week. We're going to hold that off for another week, and so that gives you a little bit more time if you missed the contest. That is, if you missed an opportunity to enter the contest from last week, well, I'll give you another week, and you can go and give it another try. So go back to themagicwordpodcast.com and look for the contest that is in the blog with the episode number 414 with Nate Staniforth. So let's get started here this week with our guest, Mr. Chip Romero, and I guess in absentia, Mr. Doug Henning, here on The Magic Word.
Did you see that, I guess if I heard this right or saw this right, that the script for The Magic Show, Shimada's script, went for about $800 or $750?
No, I did not see that. Is that something new? Is that Potter and Potter?
No, Luna sold her daddy's script.
Was Shimada the one who wrote The Magic Show?
No, but he got this. The very first script from the World of Magic. In other words, the first special.
Yeah.
Shimada had a script and Doug had a script. I mean, I have Doug's, but I'm just saying Luna just sold it. And somebody bought it for, like I said, about $750 or so. Interesting.
Does that sound like a little or a lot? I don't know whether that is good or bad.
One, it never went. I think they were trying to feel me out to see like if I would buy it.
Yeah.
Arian Black got on and said, "Hey, what's a script worth?" And I said, "I don't know. I've never seen one for sale." And she said, "We got $850. Somebody's wanting $850 for it." I'm like, $850. I said, "Well, hell, get $850 for it. Sounds good to me."
Yeah.
And then later I saw it on an SME or something. But you know, I'm just saying that's interesting. This Neil is, he's added a lot of, or there's a lot of, you know, there's buzz on Henning now, and some of his stuff is starting to trade.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, before we get into that, and since you've already started on that, I'm going to leave that as part of what we just recorded over here, but let me kind of also kind of get the little bit
We'll start from the beginning. Let's start from the beginning. It's all good.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and today I have a noted collector of Doug Henning memorabilia, and I thought it would be kind of interesting to go back in time because there are people who collect different kinds of things, and as I have talked with people like David Charvet or with Ken Klosterman and Tim Moore and some others who are collectors, like Tim, for an example, specializes preferably like in things from the Herman family. And so there are different people who are well known for one thing or another. Some people just collect magic in general, or they may specialize in paper or playing cards or in props and different kinds of things. But the point is that the fellow that we're going to be talking with today has had an interest not only in magic but also in collecting for a long number of years. And he has specialized in Doug Henning as his focus has become more narrow. And he is in between working on cruise ships, he's always looking for new opportunities to get some new stuff from Doug Henning. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Chip Romero. Hey there, Chip.
Hello, Scott. Thanks for having me, man.
Sure. Long introduction just to say hello, but I wanted people who didn't know much about you and your collection to know just a little bit, certainly. I know, like, you've been working cruise ships for a long number of years, and I know, like, for an example, let's say Charles Green was not working cruise ships, but he was working in trade shows. The point is that both of those being fairly lucrative markets that will allow one to have this kind of to pay for your passion, basically, I guess, for buying magic collectibles, because that's not something that is inexpensive. You know, that it seems like that they are for people who have the ways and the means, I guess. And how would somebody actually get started, you know, into collecting if they didn't have the ways and means? And how'd you get started?
Okay, for me, yeah, I never set out to become a collector.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that. This is just, you know, just acquiring things over a period of years. I have thousands of magic books just from buying magic books throughout the years.
Sure.
Any rate, back in, what was the year? It would have been about 84-ish, somewhere in there, 86-ish. The auction was in 99, the actual auction. But even before then, I'm trying to think of the exact time it was. I can look stuff up, but I'm in a different room in the house.
No, that's all right.
But at any rate, it was on the inside cover of Genie, and it was Doug Henning selling his most prized illusions. And that was, you know what, let me get to my computer and let me get that stuff online or on my screen.
Yeah,
and I can tell you about that.
Yeah, there might be some stuff.
Because, well, what had happened was this very first auction,
And who was sponsoring the auction? Was it a Potter and Potter?
No. This was Doug's mother-in-law, Debbie Dulliar.
Okay.
And so it was it's Debbie. It was Debbie's mother, Ann Dulliar. I'm sorry, her name was Ann. And so it was inside the cover of Genie, and it was all of Doug's main show. In other words, and in that auction is when Kirby bought the King Tut, the Walking Through a Mirror.
Kirby Van Burch.
And what else? Kirby Van Burch bought these pieces. And then I bought the gold production box and the disembodied. And what happened was I at that time, I didn't have any money. I was never one to go to my grandfather and ask him for money. But I did at this point because I just wanted something that belonged to Doug. And so anyway, so there's this list of stuff. And I go to my grandfather. I go, I've never asked you for money, but I need a little money. And
right.
He says, what are you looking for? I want something that belonged to Doug Henning. Well, I used to take my grandfather to see Doug Henning at the Hilton. I mean, it was kind of like they would always want to go with me. They didn't want me to go by myself, even if I was 17 years old. So my grandfather probably watched Doug three times at the Hilton. So he knew who Doug was. He knew how much I liked Doug.
Now, when you're saying the Hilton, I guess, was that like in a banquet room or did they have like an auditorium or something? And how large of a stage and what?
At the time when Doug Henning worked Las Vegas, he worked the Las Vegas Hilton, which at that time was the largest showroom in the world.
Gotcha. I was just thinking that like a Hilton, you know, like in a city. I didn't know it was Las Vegas. Pardon me. Okay.
No, it was Las Vegas Hilton, and he worked there. He opened for John Davidson. He opened for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, Neil Sedaka, Andy Williams, and of course Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
And then of course, and then there was times that he would do the whole thing himself. But for the most part, Doug was always, you know, Hilton always had two headliners. And the first time I saw Doug, he was opening for John Davidson. So again, I took my grandfather. My grandfather knew how much I liked Doug, and he knew who Doug was because he had seen him, and you know, he'd been around a young grandson around magic my whole life.
Yeah.
So I asked him. I said, "Look, I never ask you for money, but I want $1,000." And he's like, "Okay, what's it for?" And I said, "At the bottom of this list is a little gold box. It says gold production box." He goes, "What is that?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "It's just the last thing on the list. It's the cheapest thing on the list, and I just want something that belongs to Doug."
Sure.
He said, "Okay." He said, "Well, what's that next item up?" I said, "It says animal production cage." I said, "Papa, I just want $1,000. I just want this bottom thing." He goes, "Well, what's the next one?" I said, "Well, it says an animal production cage." So he produced a little deer in one of his specials with that cage.
Uh-huh.
I said, "But it's okay. You know, I just want this bottom gold production box." He goes, "Well, what's the next one up?" I said, "Well, that's the man without a middle." I said, "That's that disembodied princess. I said, that's like a really cool illusion." He said, "Is that illusion that we tried to build when you were a kid?" I said, "Yes." I said, "We did try to build one out of believe it or not, out of paneling. It did not work out very well."
But did you have plans, or you
to
just
make his grandson?
Yeah, did you have the plans?
I had Thayer plans. We didn't know how we were going to get a fake head or anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, my grandfather remembered all this. He remembered this from me being younger. And I said, "Well, that's a disembodied." And he goes, "That's the one with the fake head." And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, you need that." He goes, "We tried to make that." He goes, "How much is that?" And I said, "Well, that's $3,000. I said, "Look, I just want $1,000. I just want something that belongs to Doug." He said, "Well," he said, "why don't you get those bottom three?" So to make the long story short, the second piece, the animal production cage, was since sold to Melinda. That was already gone. So they couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And then I talked with her. When they got back in touch with me, I got, you know, talked to her, and I said, "I want the gold box, the animal production cage, and the disembodied." When she got back with me, she said, "We've got the disembodied and the gold box. We can't find the cage." And there was also talk about his head being included. She said the head wasn't included. And I said, "Of course it is. It has to be. That's part of what makes the trick valuable is it's got Doug's head in it."
Yeah.
And I guess they took it out of another illusion because it was rolling around in the bottom of the case when it came to me. But at any rate, so those two pieces, and again, that's a long answer for you, or long answer for your question. So those two pieces sat in crates on 13th Street for many years while Rhonda and I worked. And then again, now that I divorced and I would work, that stuff just stayed there. Well, I decided one day to just start displaying stuff in my house, to start looking, you know, set a few things up.
Yeah.
And it became a fever. And then in 99, and this is, I do have this date accurate as can be because it's burned into my memory. It's April 16th, 1999 was the auction of everything that Doug decided he would keep. And what it was those pieces from the 80, I want to say the 89 auction. It must have been 89. And so what I've since deduced is the only two people that bought anything when that was in the cover of Genie was Kirby Van Burch and myself. And I don't think anybody bought anything else because that stuff came up again in 99.
Yeah.
And that's when I bought 8 of the 14 pieces. And so now I'm starting to collect Doug. And then it was within time I went to his family and I bought all of his baby pictures, his Boy Scout medals, his yearbooks, his report cards. And then again, too numerous to mention, I mean, 250 pounds of newspaper clippings. So what it was a chain of events that caused this with me. I did not start out to be a collector, but it got to where, wow, I got a little bit and I wanted a little bit more. And then for instance, I have 27 of his costumes.
Right.
I have, you know, it's,
well,
and
sometimes
I'm always buying stuff.
One thing kind of leads to another. I mean, if you're going to be having one or two, then you want three or four, and before long, but in this case, it was all specifically having to do with Doug Henning. As an aside, you were talking about Kirby Van Burch then also. So he was the only main bidder against you at the time, and have you since talked with him? I guess you do from time to time, and maybe try buy some of the things that he has from his collection, or is he still collecting?
He has gotten rid of everything except the walking through a mirror.
Okay.
And again, I mean, he's not, I don't think he's really collecting much anymore or anything, but he, for a while there, I mean, he had Doug's Fountain Levitation, of course, as well.
Yeah.
And so again, I mean, we met and talked, but he called me up trying to buy stuff for me, but I'm not one to sell stuff. I very seldom sell anything.
Yeah. Well, when you do, do you ever, instead of selling, you know, most collectors also prefer to trade. In other words, what have you got for trade? It's not like how much is it. It's like, what have you got that I want? And so that's why I think a lot of times somebody may come across a collection that will have something in it that may not be part of what they're collecting. As I said, if someone, let's say, is collecting Houdini stuff, which happens to be, of course, very hot and expensive, that if you buy someone's collection, but it also includes some Henning things, they may say, hey, I know a Henning collector, and so I want to get hold of with Chip Romero, because he's the foremost expert in the world over here on Henning, and so he may want this, and perhaps he's got some Houdini stuff, and I can trade for him, you know. So is that...
I get the calls all the time of people trying to offer me stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you never say never. It's like I've got everything, but you don't always have everything. You know, there's always something.
Yeah.
And Chris Mitchell the other day sent me a playbill, a Doug Henning playbill, and I did not have that playbill.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's almost like just assume I have everything, but then again, sometimes I don't. I'll give you, for instance, when I bought the Henning collection, or from the family, there was all of these playbills from the Magic Show, and it's just a bunch of duplicates. Well, as I started looking at them, they're not duplicates. They're actual every week he was performing. So it was playbills from the entire run that he was in the Magic Show on Broadway.
Wow.
So again, it's, you know, trying to, for instance, I've got probably about 100 magazines, and I've scanned all the articles in all the magazines. There was just so much about him that it's never been in one place before. Now it's all in one place and it's all getting scanned. And anyway, I've gone off to go. Anyway, ask me another question.
Yeah. Well,
I've gone off into another direction.
So it's easy.
Keep me focused, Scott. I'll talk all night.
It's easy to do. Well, as far as the costumes, let's stay on that for just a moment. You say you have about 23 costumes, and these are from the TV show and from Merlin and from the Magic Show, I assume?
Okay. I've got them in front of me now. For instance, I've got the robes from the first special. I've got the costume from the Fountain Levitation, the costume from the motorcycle, the costume from the artist studio, the costume from walking through a brick wall, the Tom Bosley costume, four or five sets of the overalls, the white costume, all the cost, the shark, the outfit for the shark when he changes the shark, most of the stuff on front of all the programs, you name it, it's there. Everything from the Osmond special, everything from the Broadway special. Just got a bunch of them.
Now, in that, I remember you and I have talked before about owning Doug's things, but you don't have all of Debbie's costumes. Is that right? Or is that something else?
I have one of Debbie's.
Okay.
I have one of Debbie's. And the one I have is the one that's in the poster of New Evening of Magic and Wonder, which is the butterfly, which was actually worn in the second or the fourth special by the Asian girl, Jinji Lee, who appeared on the bridge. She's wearing a gorgeous costume. And what they did was they recycled that, put Debbie in that.
Okay.
That poster.
Now, is that the poster that's the large one where he's holding a crystal ball and she's in the crystal ball?
He's holding his hand out and she's floating above his
that's
hand,
it.
Sitting like a butterfly.
Yes, yes, that's the one. Okay, gotcha.
He's in a blue top. He's in a blue velvet top.
Yeah. And you have that top?
I do. There's a miniature her floating over his hand in that butterfly.
Yeah.
And like I said, that butterfly was used in the fourth special with him and Shields and Bosley.
Got it. So. Okay. Interesting. So some of the paper I know you have, we talked before, like from the Magic Show, that's another thing. It's not like, okay, well, I've got one, I don't need another one, but you've got a stack of them.
Well, I've got all the playbills from when he was there, but I mean, I've got the scripts of Spellbound. I've got the business proposals. This is the thing that I'm going through now, trying to make heads or tails of it. And there's probably some people around that could still help me, but I've got all the correspondence for the Canadian grant, which is one of the most famous things in his story about getting that money from the government that magic equaled art. And I've got all the correspondence went back and forth. That's kind of a book in itself.
I'd like for you to kind of touch on that, if not go into more detail, because some younger people may not necessarily know the story about how that he had that grant. Because, you know, it was interesting. I just read an article within the past few weeks about they were looking for a teacher to instruct magic in Canada. I believe that they were starting to interview, because they were saying, what if there really was a real Hogwarts? Well, they're building a magic curriculum, I guess, at the college, and they're looking for someone to be the dean of the department or something. But way before they even, before Rowling had ever envisioned having Harry Potter, that was something that I think was interesting, that not only was dug way before his time, but, you know, he really blazed the trail as far as creating this major in entertainment, of having magic as the as his major in college there in Canada. So can you address that, just talk about that just a moment?
Well, it just that the only, I mean, all I know basically what's said in the bio, he basically went to the Canadian government and he said that magic was an art, and that art was, you know, he could get a grant from an art just like any other art. And he proved it was an art form, and he got money, and that's when he came over and studied with Vernon and Sliding.
Right.
He took that money and came over and studied, and then of course, you know, I mean, of course, it all went crazy from there. You know, Magic Show was actually, it was Spellbound. It was the very first thing he did in Toronto. It was his own thing, and that later would become the Magic Show. So the one thing about Doug that people don't, I guess we've forgotten, it's, you know, it's kind of like Lance Burton. You've seen so many acts now throw birds and they fly back. You go, oh, that's just what they all do. We forgot that Lance was the first guy to ever do that. You know, you just kind of forget. Before Doug, there were no roads. In other words, there were no magic specials. Yes, Mark Wilson had done some pretty incredible stuff in Texas, but not like what Doug was going to do. And so Doug basically made those roads. And if you look at Copperfield in the beginning, he's actually following Doug's blueprint. Copperfield wanted to be, you know, he had the Magic Man on Broadway.
Right.
Doug had the Magic Show. Copperfield was actually following his blueprint, is what happened there. And then Copperfield got on TV and went a lot further. But
right.
The point is that there were no roads. In other words, there were no specials. And Doug was able to pitch that. And Doug basically, they say he opened the door and Copperfield walked through it, but Doug opened that door and we all walked through it. I mean, it's...
Well, that's, you know, a good point.
He's responsible for all that.
And going back to Mark Wilson, he, like several other local people, I mean, as you said, Texas, when he was on television at the Magic Land of Alakazam and presented for a while, I think he was sponsored by Dr. Pepper. And also there were other local channels that would have magic and magicians, or local Saturday morning TV shows or something for kids. But, you know, Mark was one of the first ones to kind of go on a weekly basis on the network, certainly. But, yeah, I think Doug Henning was the first one that I remember of being a full-length one-hour magic show special. Now, did Exxon, as I recall, was the one who had sponsored that. Did they come to him, or did he go out trying
to
sell that?
Okay. Real quick, just so we're thorough. Mark Wilson, his magic circuses were literally groundbreaking. They were unbelievable. He also had those It's Magics that would come on every now and then.
Oh, that's right.
Saturday night.
I forgot about those.
So Mark is a monster. It didn't take off the way, I don't know why it didn't either, because maybe it's because they pushed it so much as it was live. Because every time Doug would go to somebody, they would say, no, people think it's camera tricks. No. They wouldn't even listen. And then Doug would say, look, we're going to do it live. They'll know it's not camera tricks, with all the hype. And that's still, I think, if my numbers are right, that's still the most watched magic special ever. It was millions and millions and millions, because there was nothing else to do. I mean, by the time Copperfield was banished in the Statue of Liberty, that was an event. People stayed home and watched that. They didn't.
Right.
You didn't have VCRs, and it was a much different time.
Yeah, good point.
So, this is all over TV. This is going to be live. It's going to be live.
And what year was this?
That was the very first magic special of Doug's was 1975,
okay.
December 26, 1975.
I'm looking at this as we're talking. I'm looking right now at this poster that's hanging in my hallway of Houdini, Water Torture Escape. You said the sensational with the Henning. It's the drawing. You know, the big poster that advertised that with was it.
Think of how cool this is. That special had its own poster.
Yeah, guess that's, I hadn't done it.
You know what I mean? In other words, they didn't have posters. Doug really did this right. And for the record, it was Mobil Oil.
Mobil. Sorry, I guess I can see that over there. Yeah, okay.
No, I'm just we got to be all clear. Since we're podcasting, we got to be all
That's right, this goes out, that's right.
Hey, when Murray was doing Pawn Stars with the handcuffs, he would say, you know, when they used to fly, I'd go, whoa, wait. They go, who the hell is that? They go, well, I'm the advisor to the historian here. I'm the one telling him what to say.
Yeah.
Man, they didn't fly back then. So, you know what I mean?
Right.
They didn't. They didn't fly. So you have to change things. You got to be all historic here for this podcast.
That's right. And so that was the first one. So the story that I had heard about that, because again, as I'm looking at that, that's a picture of Henning upside down, water torture, escape of Houdini's, obviously. And in fact, just a quick aside on that poster, I bought that years ago because Lee Jacobs was advertising on the inside cover of the Linking Ring magazine, and it was like, I think $20 or $25, and I didn't get one. And then I noticed that after about 6 months, it went up to like $50. And then another 6 months went to $100. I thought, if I'm going to get one, it sounds like this might be a good investment. And so I did. I don't know how much are they worth now, by the way. Any idea?
They went as high as $6 to $7.
Wow.
And you can get them now probably for about $350 or $4.
Okay.
But still, you know what was funny? Lee Jacobs, I miss him. That guy had a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, he did.
I bought a lot of his manuscripts, and I miss him. I thought he was an interesting character. But yes, that poster went up pretty high, and then it went back down. And it's, you know, Henning stuff for the longest was quite cheap. You could get a Henning photograph for $10 or whatever.
Well, that's because he was a contemporary as opposed to an older person who had long since passed. So say like Houdini or Thurston or whoever, you know, a lot. And that's what I tell people if they're going to be getting involved in some sort of collecting. The thing to do is to collect your contemporaries because it's cheaper. I mean, the entry level is at a much lower level and it may not be worth as much in your short lifetime, but if you start to like this poster right there, see, that's already increased in value in Henning, and you know, you just kind of continue to outlive it, I guess. You're right that they, when they're contemporaries, like for a while, David Copperfield's was pretty cheap then as well. They're probably starting to get worth a little bit more. So I would say that you should probably just jump in there.
With David, there's so much of it.
That's a good point. Yeah.
That's, you know. Yeah.
But so anyhow, I was going
to
say, go ahead.
He's starting to trade now. So I'm just saying that Doug is starting to trade now, and it's pretty interesting.
Yes. So going back to this poster, though, my point was, and I want to see if you can verify the story that I have heard before, and that is that whenever he was talking with Mobil, that they were in the pitch meeting, I guess, and saying something about, well, we will underwrite this if you can do the underwater torture of Houdini's, and we can promote that. And he said, absolutely. And so they said, okay.
He pitched it to them.
Okay. But
he said, I'm going to do something that's never been done on TV. I'm going to do Houdini's trick. I'm going to do the death-defying Chinese water torture cell. And they went, wow. And he goes, okay. And then they walked out, and he goes, okay, now we got to figure out how to do it.
And, yeah, his first call was Johnny Gaughan.
Ab Dixon.
Oh, Ab Dixon, okay.
No, Ab Dixon. They went to Lund's Museum of Magic and looked at Houdini's.
Right.
I've got pictures of all the rehearsals and everything with that going on. Of Doug in regular clothes being lowered into this thing, and I've got some incredible pictures a lot of his rehearsal before the specials, and there's pictures of him and Dennis Loomis, is your good friend Loomis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Him and Ab Dixon are hanging out, and they're looking at this water torture cell, and they're figuring out how to do it.
Hmm.
I've got some really cool pictures of him upside down with oxygen bottles and stuff in there, and them trying to make notes, you know, make signs to him and stuff while he's upside down, and he's got an oxygen bottle in his mouth. Pretty
now,
cool.
Why was Ab involved? I mean, he's not a builder. I know he was a performer.
That's because Ab knew a lot, and Doug was young. We're all young at one point, and we need help.
Yeah.
And you know, you didn't have, say, Steinmeier wasn't in the game yet. You know, Steinmeier. You know, eventually Steinmeier would be on salary for Doug, but I'm just saying that back then, and you'd be surprised the amount of ideas that Doug had that were his ideas. It's mind-numbing that you know, you think, oh, Steinmeier thought of everything. Steinmeier thought of a lot, but Doug thought of a lot himself.
Right. Well, I know that John Gaughan was involved, and that was where I guess I misunderstood. I thought that he had called John Gaughan to help create that. I know John came in, I guess, at a later time, but I guess he wasn't.
John came in later. John didn't come into the second special. That was Les Smith. I'll tell you, two guys that don't get it. Now, everybody knows how incredible John Gaughan is. John Gaughan is one of our greatest treasures.
Yes.
God, we're lucky to have him.
You're not kidding.
We're lucky to have him on more levels than we even know.
Mm-hmm.
And what an interesting cat and a cool guy. And, you know, and he got his start as a young builder with Mark Wilson.
Mark Wilson, right, yeah.
That's where Johnny came from. So you know, all of Mark's beautiful work was all Johnny.
I had a conversation with John Gaughan that's on an older podcast. If people want to go back and do research, you can go to the website. In fact, you can also see a couple of videos that I took there at John's workshop in his museum and everything, plus the conversation he talks about this very thing, you know, coming in and working with
John's.
Everybody.
He's one of our greatest treasures.
Yeah.
We're lucky he didn't want to be an astronaut, because he'd have been a hell of an astronaut.
Yeah, but you're saying...
You know, he'd have been whatever he was going to be.
But you're going to say Les Smith?
A lot of people don't really remember. Les Smith was the first guy that was really building illusions that were thin and sexy and starting to look cool. Doug and Les, when they did the magic show, I don't know if you're aware of this, the magic show, they basically went into Owens and said, "What do you have in stock?" And they showed them a bunch of tricks in stock, and they wrote the magic show to those tricks that were in stock.
Huh, didn't know that.
And I actually have the correspondence between Doug and Les on the sawing, when the sawing was being made, and the correspondence about how much this three-sword, girl on three-swords would cost. So all that stuff. Anyway, what happened was the first special was all Owen magic. And then Johnny, I don't know how they met. I just know that Johnny was going to do a lot of stuff in the second special. And Les told Doug, "If you do that, I won't work with you anymore." And I guess there was no choice. And Doug had Johnny build stuff. And Les never talked to Doug again.
Wow.
Les was he's pissed. Because he really did. He was at the very beginning of that.
Yeah.
And of course, like I said, afterwards, Johnny started making illusions that, you know, that Thurston and Keller only dreamed of looking at.
Right, they
like
were
that.
Unique. Well, there are new things, of course, we could do now that they didn't have back then. And John has great knowledge, certainly. So what about the script? I'm sorry, not the script writing, but the music that accompanied that. So Doug went in to Owen and saw the tricks that would go with it, and then someone had to come in actually and write the music around that.
I would have to pull all those things out to give you accurate names.
Okay.
But again, I mean, Reitman was, or not Reitman. I got it all right here. See, Spellbound. I can't see the date on this. At any rate, go ahead. Next question. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
No, we'll come back to it.
Okay. So then they developed that. I just wondered, was it the same person or group who had worked with the music on the magic show that also worked later with Merlin?
I don't think so.
Okay. I just wondered. Now, David Ogden Stiers had just recently passed, and I know he was involved. It was Merlin, not the magic show. Was he in? Which one was he in? David Ogden Stiers.
I'm not sure. I'd have to pull those things out. I would have to pull programs out and look. I mean, I don't know every single name involved with everything.
Well, he was the guy that used to be on MASH. Remember on the TV show MASH, that played Winchester.
Okay. That wasn't Merlin. He was in the Magic Show.
He was, yes.
Okay. That's the guy on MASH. Okay. He was the original villain in the Magic Show. The original.
Okay. Okay. Now, you say originally, you mean going back to Canada, even, before he came to the States?
Not Canada.
No, that was Spellbound.
Okay.
Pardon me.
Canada was Spellbound.
Yeah.
Toronto was
okay.
Spellbound.
Yeah, I'm with you now.
And Magic Show was New York.
Okay. I understand. Okay.
And he was in New York. He was at the Magic Show in New York.
Now, as I recall, the Magic Show was one of the longest running musicals ever. Is that right at the time?
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
What I know beyond a shadow of a doubt is it opened in 1974. Doug's last show was October 31st, 1976. And I think it went two or three years after that, and it toured. But there was different people in it, Peter DePaula, and there's somebody else. I mean, I don't really know much about after Doug left. I just know what was going on when Doug was there.
Now, when you say when Doug left, they still had another magician that took the place of Doug Henning in the show while he was on
yes.
tour?
Yes.
Oh, that's
yes.
interesting.
Yes.
Huh.
Here's an interesting thing. When they put the magic show together, Doug's salary was like, I'm going to say $300 a week or something. It was not much money.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the magic in Spellbound was Doug's magic. And I can go back and show you pictures of him as a teenager doing these tricks at banquets and stuff. Mm-hmm. As I've got all those things. And it's amazing how his act became Spellbound. So now his act ends up becoming the magic show. Well, when he's leaving the magic show, they basically said, all this magic belongs in here. You can't take this magic with you. And he said, no, it's my magic. They said, well, you're not getting it. It's part of the show. And so he was furious that his most prized possession, what he loved more than anything else was that tournament story newspaper. He loved it.
Yeah.
He guarded it. He did not want other people doing it. And it was just too late because we all saw it and saw how great it was. And we all started doing it.
Right.
Well, in the show in New York, he was forced to teach that to the magician. And then when the touring show happened, it was taken out. But basically, Doug was just, his magic act became part of this show. A beautiful thing, and there's great articles in Magic Magazine on this, about how the magic show, people went, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm just basically saying, the show sucks. The music was terrible. The lighting was terrible. The script was terrible. It was terrible. But I'm buying a ticket again tomorrow. Why are you buying a ticket? Well, I'm going to go see Doug Henning. So what's mind-boggling to me is that this guy made it against all the odds. He was any bad reviews of a Broadway show would probably wipe anybody out. Instead, they were saying the show was crap, but you've got to go see this little Canadian guy in there.
Yeah.
And so he actually rose above all of that, which is incredible. And then with all of the hype on that, that's when he got the first television special. And this is interesting. I've often tried to think about this, and it's impossible because I can't be him. But how did it feel after he's done his first special, December 26, 1975? You know, all hell breaks loose. Now he goes back to New York to go back into the magic show. It's you know, it's 76 now. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the people beating the doors down, wanting to meet this guy?
Good point.
And now it's October of 76. It's October 31st. And the reason I know this is I've got a picture of his mother took at him. He's sitting at his desk with a big bouquet of flowers. He's in the white outfit. It's obviously he's just walked off stage. He's looking in the mirror and he's just kind of smiling. And it says on the back of the picture, Last Magic Show. So I know that was taken by his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Man, what was he thinking? Because he was on his way to L.A. to do the second special that would really and truly go crazy again. I mean, that was the Fountain Levitation, the Fire Dome, all that, you know, all that great stuff, all that great Johnny stuff. And so, again, he went from October to December, he was doing his second special. And, you know, of course, he never went. And the Magic Show kept going on. But it never had the same reviews or anything because it was done. I mean, the star left.
Right, I understand. They came to see him, not necessarily the magic or whatever, that he was really an international superstar. You know, I think it's interesting that what you said there, Chip, as far as all of the things that were in his show that were the large illusions and the spectacle and everything, particularly on his television specials. However, it was the first trick that opened it was John Cornelius' Vanishing Nickel.
Pickle Nickel.
Yeah, Fickle Nickel.
Hell yeah.
That was a heck of a way. I mean, that was pretty bold. I mean, for someone, an illusionist, that this whole show was based upon grandeur and everything, and dance, et cetera, and color and spectacle, to have the camera focused on his hand, you know, showing front and back, and then suddenly, you know, making that nickel appear. Very cool.
No, and also, I don't think any of us had seen it.
Yeah, that was new.
I keep going back thinking how young I was, and I was already reading Magic Book, and I thought I knew everything. And so that's what was so much fun. I'd seen a plan for an Azra.
Yeah.
And so my dumb just thought, oh, well, the girls at the table. I thought I knew everything all of a sudden. And then you start seeing the shadow box, and you just go, my God, there's no bass there. She couldn't be there, you know?
Yeah.
And, or he does the center cutting. You know, and I'm not familiar with the placement of mirrors, the periscope. I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah.
There's no base there. I mean, I was just, you know, fooled badly,
right,
constantly throughout that special. And I'll say this, and then we'll jump to the next question. But I'll never forget when he pulled that sheet off of Lori Lieberman. I'd never seen a Dakota chair in my life, and that to date is still one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life.
The vanish, that the culture.
Oh, God, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, I want to go back just to the Torn Restored newspaper here because, again, that going back to the TAOM convention that Mark Jensen was the president back in Dallas a few years ago, and he had brought you in.
Oh, that was fun.
That was fun. Your part was one of the most memorable parts of that whole convention, and people really missed it because that you brought that you know, some of the props and also the, I forgot, what was that called again, where it had Doug Henning's face, his mask?
Well, we had fun. We had Doug's metamorphosis. We had where the ducks go. We
the girls had a metal.
The disembodied.
Yeah.
Right.
But then behind you of that fans. That big scrim and everything that that filled the whole stage, that was the clouds. I mean, you haven't probably been able to display that before.
That was his backdrop. No, that was the backdrop for the Hilton. That backdrop is 50 feet by 30 feet. It's huge.
Yeah. So there are not many places where you can display that, except at a convention.
No,
like that.
We did good on that. That was a personal favor to Mark.
Yeah.
Mark's a real close friend.
Sure.
And the next time, I've actually been talking with friends of mine about possibly doing a Doug Henning weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And getting with a few people and maybe like a day or two before Magic Live or something like that.
You know, they did a Willard the Wizard weekend many years ago. This was supposed to be for his 100th birthday, which, of course, he was long past. But what they had, of course, was Frances Willard, and they had Hannah Willard, who was Michael Lamar's his wife, and some other of the Willard family. And it was just a special weekend. It was a one-off thing that was in Louisiana there. Steve Zuckerberg, I think, or Zuckerman. Zuckerman was the one who had sponsored that there in Baton Rouge. And it was a very fun weekend. So that might be something that you could do a one-off. There'd be a Henning weekend. You might be surprised how many people would show up, you know, to actually see some of these displays. Would be a one-time only and for some people's lives, you know.
He really, for us, he was our Houdini for you and me.
Good point.
In other words, he was,
I agree.
You know, Houdini was, Houdini and Barnum created publicity.
Mm-hmm.
But you and I, okay, I'm sure your interest in magic is when you were young, too.
Sure.
And, like, for me, I was watching Bill Bixby on TV. They made magic look really cool. You know, he had a white Corvette. And then Mark Wilson was on TV doing some great stuff. But when Henning came on, it everything exploded. For some reason or another, when Henning told you that magic was real, you believed him. I don't know, you know, you just believed him.
Yeah.
And so that was that big explosion of magic that... And we'll talk more about it in a minute, but I told you I'm writing a book, and one of the last things in the book is going to say that we're all living in his world of magic. We all are. I mean, this world did not exist until he showed up.
As you said, he opened the door, and then the rest of us have been walking through it. So it's not just been David Copperfield that's taken advantage, but all of us, really. Yeah, that's true.
David is obviously our greatest treasure, as in, I don't know anybody with a work ethic like that. I don't know anybody anywhere with a work ethic like that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I just, without Doug paving those roads, you know, I don't know if David probably would have made something happen. There's no way David was destined for it. He was going to, you can see how hard he's worked.
Sure.
That he was going to be somebody. There's no doubt about it. He would have kept going until he was somebody.
Right.
He just happened to do it early. But again, it was because of the explosion in magic that Doug created is what gave David the road to go,
right.
You know, to go knock on the doors.
But going back again to the TAOM convention, when you were doing that, one of the other presenters was our mutual friend Gene Anderson. And Gene had
We love Gene Anderson.
Yes. And there were some stories that Gene had told me. And I've known Gene for 30-some years, and we've been very good friends, and we've talked about, I don't know, I thought everything, but we had never talked about Doug Henning. And he was telling about how the Doug had lived with him for a while, and, of course, when he had taught him the Torn Restored newspaper and him being at the first show in the front row and all the rest of this. And there were some amazing stories. I did not know that they were that close. I just thought that was something that – that Doug liked the Torn Restored newspaper, which makes perfect sense because he didn't like it just because, number one, it's a great trick, but number two, that Gene was one of his closest friends because he and Debbie had lived with him for a while.
But it was Doug's trick. He you know, again, I mean, I guess people, I mean, Sidini was tearing newspapers up. Johnny Thompson was tearing newspapers up.
Yeah.
We had just not seen that flash restoration. You know what's funny? A lot of people don't even know this. In the Harbin book is a phenomenal torn and restored newspaper with a flash restoration.
Hmm.
And nobody does it because all the collectors hoard the book.
That's a good point.
But there was other newspapers. There was other great newspaper tears. But when Doug did it is when we – that's a whole different podcast. One day we'll talk about seeing two performers do a trick. One performer does a trick and you don't even think about it. You see another performer do the same trick and you go, my God, that trick's got something going. And it's a whole different realm.
Like the egg bag that Jeff Hobson does.
Sure. But when Doug tore that newspaper – he will forever be the guy that we'll remember with the newspaper.
Yeah.
And in talking with Gene, I don't know if you talked to him, also part of the I'm not tearing the paper or whatever is
an illusion. It just sounds like
I haven't torn the paper at all. That was Willard Wizard.
Oh, really?
There's one line. Yes, yes, one of those lines. It's either I'm not tearing the paper or I will fuse the paper together was actually a line used by Willard the Wizard. That's his homage to Willard, just since you brought Willard up.
On Willard, by the way, is just kind of another aside. When I was talking with David Charvet, again, going back to another podcast, and I was asking him about, in his research, who he thought was one of the most or the best all-time best magicians ever. And he said, it's not just me, but I constantly hear people saying that Willard the Wizard was the preeminent magician, not only of his time, but he is someone who had the best presentation and was the best magician. So in other words, he would preempt Thurston, Keller, or any of them. But because
they still talk about his thumb tie. Still talk about Willard's tie.
Yeah, right. That's right. So anyhow, then as far as other things, then Henning was continuing to, and I mentioned David Charvet then again, because he was one of the people or was the last person to do a major interview with Doug Henning, which was published after his death in Magic Magazine. That is after Doug's death. Dave is doing fine. But that was very interesting because that no one knew, even at that time while David was talking with Doug, that he was in such serious ill health.
That, according to Steinmeier, the only people that knew was Debbie and his doctor.
Okay.
That's what Steinmeier told me. I asked Steinmeier years ago, you know, I said, you didn't know? He goes, nobody knew.
Yeah.
Somebody who went to see him, somebody went to see him to drop some tricks off. I think it was a guy named Dan Birch, a really great Doug worker out of L.A.
Yeah.
Dan Birch, I think, went to drop something off to him, and he had to talk to him up behind the stairs.
Huh.
And Doug was like up at the stairs, and he said, hey, thank you so much for bringing it. You know, I'm sorry I can't come down, but I really appreciate it. And I guess that's because Doug had done one chemo.
Right.
And I guess it almost killed him. I mean, Doug, I don't think Doug ever weighed over 130 pounds.
He was tiny. He was a diminutive guy. You know, along that line, when I had met him, I saw him at the Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis performing, and it was a great show. And afterwards, I got a chance to go backstage and shake hands, take a couple of pictures. And he was interested in talking about magic. But what was interesting, though, further, there were a couple of ladies who were interested in transcendental meditation. And when they said TM, boy, he just turned on his heel, and, you know, no one else was in the room except just him and those two ladies. I mean, whatever conversation, whatever other interest, you know, that like this was his main focus. And I remember that for some reason he was going to be going off and creating Veda Land in India. And I thought, how can that be when people over there can't afford shoes, you know, in the area where I understand he was going to be building? I mean, how could you have a theme park?
No, well, he was with the Maharishi in India, and they were designing Veda Land.
Okay.
And they wanted Veda Land to be in Orlando.
Oh, it wasn't going to be in India. Okay.
No. It was in India with the Maharishi. Veda Land was meant to be in Orlando. They had some bright idea that they would open up this transcendental meditation theme park next to Disney.
Yes.
And that's how they would get this overflow or whatever.
Sure.
And Disney owns Orlando, and it didn't happen. Disney's like, no, we're not going to have that. I mean, Disney owns Orlando. They really do. They can kind of call on what goes on.
You know, Universal's got a pretty big piece of Orlando. Somehow they kind of got in the back door. And so if, you know, when people are down there now, they're competing, you know, against them. But, yeah, I remember way back when, before Disney World was built, of course, and Disney was buying property just under different names and just kind of keeping it quiet because they knew if it was Disney, they'd be jacking up the property values and everything, you know.
Sure, that's true.
Right. Yes, but that never got off the ground. I mean,
I have lots of correspondence on that. They were trying. Doug even went into politics in Canada trying to do something with red tape, and it didn't work out.
Was he going to get? Was he running for Congress or something?
It's not Congress. It was the something party. I don't know their political system.
Their parliament or something.
It's whatever. I mean, I don't know their political system. So, but yeah. He was writing for something, or he was running for the People Something Party. And again, it never happened. It wasn't going to happen. We can talk more about his departure. everything that I'm writing or everything that I'm interested in would be between Spellbound and be about 86, about when he left. That's where I'm at. When it gets further into that. And by the way, a lot of people don't know this. They say that he got into TM and it took him away from Magic.
Right.
Doug Henning was in TM way before he ever started. Doug Henning was, before anybody even knew who Doug Henning was, he was touring with a band called Waves, and they were doing stuff on the Transcendental, the TM movement. So he was always in the TM. He was always into it. He didn't just all of a sudden get into it and leave Magic. He was always in the TM.
It seems that I had heard that he had some back injury or something, perhaps related to jumping in and out of the Metamorphosis too many times or something, but he could just use TM to kind of center himself and heal himself.
He also said he could use TM to float, and that never happened.
Yeah.
And another thing, we also know TM doesn't work, okay? Liver cancer killed the guy. He was 52 years old. He never drank. He never smoked. And his TM didn't do very well on that either. So, yeah. I mean, not to slam TM, but
yeah,
I'm just saying that he thought that he would use TM to get well, and it didn't work.
So. Let me ask you about your book here then also, as we kind of start to wrap up a little bit. And that is that you said...
Wrap up? I'm just getting started, man.
I know.
I'm getting ready to put in another throat lobster. And you know what? Real quick, before you say this, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to hold... since it's on the podcast, you'll be held to it. Boss, you need to come sit in my living room, and we need to look at these pictures while we talk about this. And we need to look at these scripts and look at this stuff.
Yeah.
And we can do... Next time we do this, when you have time, you come sit over here for 2 hours, and we'll look through stuff and talk through stuff, and that'll be a hell of a podcast.
I'd love to do that because I can ask you about.
And I can be real accurate on the dates and stuff because I've got all. I have filed so much stuff. I'm going through 250 pounds of newspaper clippings right now. I'm scanning all these newspaper clippings and trying to put them together. I've got tour schedules, and I've still got 4 or 5 boxes I haven't even opened. Let me give you the idea on the book. I did not start out, again, this was not anything close to my mind when I started collecting all this stuff, but I started thinking it'd be kind of neat to, if I, you know, talk to some of the magicians that knew him and do some little essays.
Yeah.
Well, again, it just kind of hovered in the back of my head. So I'm on the Norwegian Pearl. I finished my show and a crew staff walks up and says, there's a lady back there. She wants to talk to you. She's crying. And I thought to myself, oh, God, what did I do now?
Right.
You know, you never know about audiences, and it's 1,100 seats. I'm like, what did I do now? So I walk up, and she's sitting back there on a little hum around, and she's just crying, just squalling and bawling. And she goes, I got to tell you, she goes, your tribute to Doug Henning brought back all these memories. And I'm overwhelmed. And I'm like, really? And she shows me this little pendant she's wearing. And it's like a little moon in a circle.
Yeah.
And she says, Doug gave this to me when I was 17 years old. She goes, I was at the People's Magazine photo shoot. She goes, I was really into Doug.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you know what? Like, maybe we should have a little interview and let's do a talk. And I say, because I'm actually looking for people that might have known him. Anyway, we sit down one night and I recorded just like you're doing. I recorded an hour conversation with her. And I started thinking, wow, if I could start doing these essays. And then with all these pictures, I've got, you know, literally thousands of pictures that's never been seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, well, I'll do like a little Carter scrapbook, kind of like what Phil Temple did.
Right, right.
And then like 4 cruises go by and these guys walk up to me and they go, we went to school with him. We were hanging out in the dorm with him. So I took their numbers. It was interesting how my job actually, and I do tributes, people would walk up afterwards and tell me stories. So I've got a lot of those stories already
that's
recorded.
Cool. Yeah.
And so those are going to be the little essays in between all these pictures. Well, now Gene Anderson was helping me, giving me some advice about it, about different people to interview. And so I'm interviewing them, and I'm in no hurry to do this. It's a labor of love. But I'm going to write the definitive book on him. I mean, you know, the Spellbound book that came out was very good. But again, there's just too many people that weren't talked to. And through, like I said, but talking with these guys, for instance, the guy says, yeah, we used to hang out with him in the dorm room, said that Doug had a little aquarium with silverfish in it, and he would go out and trap flies, and they would bring flies into his room, and they'd let the flies loose, and they'd watch the silverfish snap the flies out of the air. And then, I mean, what a great story. Another thing, in his bios, we're told that his lungs collapsed when he was young, and he had asthma, and he was very sickly. When Doug was young, Doug was a baseball player, and he was an all-star track runner. As in a real all-star track runner, there's pictures of him in the yearbook.
Yeah.
So he was very athletic. He was just skinny, but he was very athletic. Another thing, I've got a lot of pictures of him as a mime. A lot of people don't know that Doug was a mime when he was like 16, 17 years old. He said, I'll teach you the mime.
Didn't he study with Shields and Yarnell? Or he had them on their special, I think.
Well, they did a special with him, but Doug was a mime before he was ever anything.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he's a young kid, and he's the Choo-Choo the Clown.
Uh-huh.
So he's a mime, and so, again, like there's scrapbooks of this. Most people have never even seen this. They didn't even know that he was a mime.
So what you're going to be collecting and putting together in this book, it sounds like, will it just be one volume? It sounds like might be more later.
I don't know. And another thing, here's something interesting. They'll go nameless, but I've had a couple of people, and if they're listening to this, they'll know it's each of them or it's not them. But I had a couple of people that was interested in wanting to work with me, and when I told them it's not about money, they got out.
Huh.
It's not about money. I'm going to overproduce this thing.
Yeah.
The idea is to produce a book, you know, that's 70 or 80 bucks that anybody can afford, or that most people can afford, but at the same time, it's going to end up looking like a $200 book. Because I'm not after money on this. It's not about, you know, I mean, I've made plenty of money cruising. So this is about fun.
It's a tribute to Doug Henning.
Basically, I bought all this stuff, and Gene Anderson told me if I didn't write a book, he was going to come after me. And so I don't want to upset Gene Anderson.
Well, you know, I know how long it took took Gene to write his book for years and years.
It's not taking me 10 years to write my book. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know whether Gene was ever going to get that book out, you know, but because
are we ever going to get the Blaney book? I'm going to call Walter and go, look, I'll just produce the damn thing. Give it to me. Hey, we're finally going to get Johnny's book. It's about time.
Right. That's true.
They've been writing on that forever, too. And I'm waiting on Johnny's book, and I'm waiting on Walter's book, Walter Blaney.
I've been talking to Walter about every time I see him. I say, well, how's the book coming? Well, I'm working on it. Yeah, okay. You know, he always keeps little index cards in his shirt pocket, and he takes things out and jots down notes. So he said, this is going to be going in the book. And, he's been working on that for, at least 15 years. I don't know how far he is into it, though. But, I hope he does.
It's interesting because he's a killer, too. Old Walt Walter's a killer.
Yep, no question. Well, listen, I appreciate the time that you've given us, and I do plan to come over to visit. And for those who are interested in hearing more about Doug Henning, you have to come back for our second chat, which will be sometime in the future that I'll post. But
I'm serious. You find the way over here, and like I said, brother man, we'll be sitting right next to the shadow box when I'll tell you the stories of Glenn Priest putting the fins on, because those fins. Shadow boxes didn't look like that.
Right.
Those fins were placed on there because of angles, and now all the shadow boxes that come after look like that. There's all these necessity things that have happened that are now just standards in magic, and we take them for granted, and it was all paid by this little Canadian guy, Doug Henning.
Yeah,
you know?
That's amazing.
He was the first guy doing close-up on – when he was on the Hilton stage, which was the largest stage in Las Vegas,
uh-huh.
He had two televisions. And those were those projection televisions that were very expensive, and only rich people had those. He had two of those, one on each side of him on stage when he was doing the close-up, sitting cross-legged in the middle of the stage in a spotlight.
Hmm.
It was absolutely incredible. It was, I mean, before all the video walls and stuff, it was incredible watching this guy sit cross-legged doing this close-up magic on this huge stage with these two televisions on each side of him.
I think
it was very interesting.
What was partially amazing to me was how invested and interested and excited that he was. In other words, it was as if he was experiencing magic for the first time also. You talk about fresh. I've never seen any magic more fresh than what Doug Henning could produce, because when he performed it, it was like, I'm going to show you something amazing. It's like, isn't that cool? And it was just, you get excited watching him. And so I can understand why when he was on Broadway that people would come just to see him, because no one else has done it before nor since with that kind of enthusiasm and freshness night after night and time after time for the same trick.
To this day, he is the most of the relaxed performers on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Our greatest performers, now look, it's where we grew up. You and I are the same on this. But our greatest performers, of course, were Henning, Copperfield, Siegfried, and Roy. That's our greatest, our showmen. And there's nothing like all three of them. There's just nothing like when you're sitting there looking up at them.
Mm-hmm.
They're all three different. They're all three incredibly charismatic.
The kings of magic, that's true.
But Doug, of all of them, is the most relaxed. It's almost like you're just sitting in the living room talking to him. And in his opening line, "Welcome to my world of magic, where I'll expand the boundaries of your imagination and fill you with wonder." That he said that every single show. And again, he said it with conviction, and then he proved it. You know, that was the thing. Doug, I do remember this. I saw his show at the Hilton 7 times in a row, and he opened with the first time I saw him, he opened with the fire hoop, and then Fire Dome, and then Miss Maid, and then Newspaper. And then the second time I saw him, he had the elevator, Fire Dome, Miss Maid, and then Newspaper. And as he handed the newspaper as he walked forward, he said, "I'm not really tearing the paper." People were laughing at him.
Mm-hmm.
They were laughing at him. They were not. I can tell you right now, they were like, "Yeah, right." I mean, he had just done 3 beautiful illusions.
Yeah.
And so they and plus he's on TV. They know he's worth their time, or their time is worth it. Anyways, he's standing there laughing, and when that paper opened up, he goes, "You don't believe me? Well, look." And I mean, the room was shell shocked. I mean, there was a 3 or 4 seconds of silence, like, "Holy, what has happened?" And he paged through, and then, of course, after that, it was over. He could do anything he wanted. And just his ring routine or his Bill and Lemon, he just incredibly relaxed, just talking.
And that would have been about what year?
Well, I saw him in 79 and 80 is
okay.
When I saw him.
Yeah. Well, as I said, here to wrap up, let me ask you, the name of my podcast is, of course, called The Magic Word. And so I might ask you, what do you think would have been his magic word or phrase?
Oh, wonder.
Wonder.
No doubt. That's what he was always, the wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Everything fill you with wonder. It was always, you know, the wonder in life. That's definitely his favorite word.
Yeah,
wonder.
That's great. Well, listen, I will
no
have
doubt.
I will, Chip, get I promise. I mean, we're just a few hours apart, and I can get over there sometime, and I will, I promise. And also I'll promise then the rest of the listeners that you'll be hearing some more on this then in the future as well, whenever we do get together.
We need to try to do something like any of your podcasts. Do they come with pictures or visuals or anything?
There are on the website, and I always encourage people to go to themagicwordpodcast.com where they can see videos, they can see photos. But a lot of people will listen to this on iTunes, or they subscribe using iHeartRadio or TunedIn or FeedPress and Stitcher and so many other kinds of things that they're on their smart device, on their phone or iPad, or they're online. But if they don't go to the website, you're kind of missing a lot of the value of this. I mean, I appreciate people who are listening, but I also spend probably more time on things I put on the blog each week than I do into the editing and everything of the podcast, you know, from week to week. There are just a lot of other material. So that's a long way of answering your question, which is yes.
You and I go back a long way.
Yes, we do.
We go back to the Magic Island days. And so for you, you come over and hang. We'll take some pictures, and then you could put some visuals on the website. With
yeah,
it.
Yep, I'll do that.
Because I've got pictures of things that nobody else has. We could put like his very first brochure on there,
mm-hmm.
and we could put a few pictures of things that we're talking about. So that just, again, you find the time, and it's just because we go back a long way.
Yeah.
You know, Mark and I go back, and so that's the reason I did that stuff. I don't like moving Doug's stuff around, or I don't like. I mean, I go through it all the time because I'm scanning,
sure.
but I'm
sure.
just saying. You were here to see all these pieces out. It was, again, it would blow your mind, the amount of playbills, the amount of just, again, I can basically chart most of his career. It's pretty
That's
incredible.
Cool. Yeah.
And I think I've already told you this, and we'll leave on this, is that I'm actually scanning all of that. And after the book is done, I'm going to just give his whole career, digitized career to the magic world. You know, they'll be able to do whatever they want with it.
And put that out on some sort of a website or something? You mean,
I don't know how I'm going to do it. I just know that everything I have will be scanned, everything will be documented and noted, and then it will just be available. In other words, if anybody wants to pull anything for book reports or whatever, or essays, it'll all be there.
Something like Ask Alexander, except it'd be Ask Doug, I guess, huh? Or Ask Chip.
But hey, maybe I'll digitize it and give it to them.
Yeah, that's not a bad
saying,
idea.
The point is that all of this stuff was before digital. And so I'm scanning it to get information to write little essays. Well, after I'm done, they can have it. Everybody can have it. So maybe I'll just give it all to them, and they can catalog it or something.
That's quite magnanimous of you. That's great. Yeah.
Because well, this for done, the world. In all honesty, I've done nothing for magic. And they always say, oh, you got to give, just not take. Well, give hell. I've bought thousands of books. I've bought over $100,000 in illusions. I've given plenty of money to the magic world. I'm good for the magic economy.
Yeah.
But I've never contributed anything, and none of my routines or anything. And so that's what I'm going to do. This might be, it might be, hey, they say, you know, we're all here for a reason. I don't know if it's true, but maybe this is why I'm in Magic. Maybe because nobody else cared about Doug years ago.
Yeah.
I know we keep talking about it, but I'll finish on this too. I went to the castle and I did an act on Monday night, and Steinmeier was coming in on Tuesday. So I did all three Doug Henning tricks. Still did my rings. And I finished the show, and Brian Lee walked up and said, man, don't change your show again. And I said, oh, you just don't like changing. He goes, no. He goes, it's the castle. It's Doug Henning. He goes, man, nobody ever talks about Doug. So I've been the one talking about Doug all these years, and now it looks like he's making a comeback. So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool.
Because these young kids need to know without him, we wouldn't be talking. He really was the biggest thing. You know, he really was our Houdini.
Yeah.
And without his world of magic, we wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't have been happening. I mean, he really... I mean, who knows? Copperfield could have done it 4 or 5 years later, but no, it's just it happened the way it happened.
Yeah, for such a small man, he did have such big shoulders for us to stand on. Now that's amazing. You're right. Well, listen,
he gave us everything. He really did.
Yeah. Well, Chip, thank you again very much. I appreciate your time and your words, and also sharing some of your vast knowledge about Doug Henning. And it's fascinating and phenomenal. I hope that this gives some of the people who didn't know as much about Doug a little glimpse into some of his background and some of his history, and will perhaps encourage them to look a little bit deeper and to study more about Doug then, too.
There's also YouTube videos of Doug, and, you know, not everything Doug did was perfect. But about three quarters of it, and three quarters of it, a lot of us are still using today.
Yeah,
his influence is still very much felt. My friend Greg Gleason's in Masters of Illusion right now. He's doing a fountain levitation. Mm-hmm. He's standing up there, all like it swirl in the water. Well, without Doug, he wouldn't be doing it. So Doug's influence is very much felt. And I closed 4 days ago. I was on a cruise ship, and I closed a show off with his newspaper. So Doug's influence magically is very much still felt.
Yeah, yeah.
Very still.
Yes.
Felt. I mean, how many fire domes are out there now?
Yeah.
You know, and that was, and all Doug did was, Doug was doing a crystal casket just like anybody else, and they just upped the game a bit.
Yeah.
You know, that's really Doug's crystal casket is what it was. But I'm just saying, look at all the fire domes now.
Right.
And again, so much that Doug, you know, that Doug gave us, or we took. I mean, look at all the shadow boxes. Everybody just started making shadow boxes. So yeah, Doug is very much still felt. In magic, and will be felt for many years. Hey, he's the reason we're all doing the culture chairs now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Doug brought all those pieces back.
So. Right. All right, well, listen.
And another one we'll talk about when him and when they were making the things that go bump and make it, you know, he made the first zigzag in his garage. And so we'll talk more about that whenever you have time.
Very cool. We will make time. Listen, thank you again, Chip. I appreciate the time. I know we could go on, and usually when we are together, we do for quite a while. So I just want to close out over here then for now, and I want to thank you again for being my guest.
Well, I thank you for having me, and anytime, brother man, I'm as close as your phone.
Okay, you bet. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Chip Romero, and this is Scotty out. I want to again thank my good buddy Chip Romero for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I know I can always call on him. I have been wanting to actually sit down and have this chat for a long time. Again, Doug Henning has been one of my personal influencers, I guess, on magic to a degree, and there are still some things in my act that I do that are from his. Just a variation of some of the things, or one of the things, at least, he used to do in his television show. Anyhow, a lot of us were, again, so impacted by this great magician, and I thought it'd be kind of interesting to hear what Chip had to say about this. And if you ever have a chance to talk with Chip or to see his collection, or if he does come about putting together this Doug Henning weekend kind of a convention, I'll certainly let you know. I think that's going to be a lot of fun, and I'll be one of the first to sign up. I know that will be well attended, and I hope that comes about. I think that'll be just a lot of fun. And if you're interested in that, drop me a note. Scott@themagicwordpodcast.com, and I'll be sure to forward those on over to Chip so that he understands that there really is a large base of people who are interested and would attend such a convention if he'd put together this whole thing. So that could be a possibility. Who knows? Well, this has been a pretty full podcast, and so we're going to wrap it up here for this week, and then next week we will return with a chat with Gregory Wilson. We talked with him some time ago, you might recall, in which there was a little bit of controversy. This will be a far less controversial podcast. This episode is just a nice chat that we had when he was passing through town, and we had a chance to sit down together with him shortly after he had his heart attack. So he kind of gives us an update on how his health condition is doing and his hopes for the future and what he's working on and that kind of a thing. So that'll be next week here on the Magic Word Podcast. So until then, stay well, get booked, and remember to give your audiences wonder. Wow. This is Scotty out.